Good afternoon, this is Quintus Curtius, and this podcast is going to be, I don't know if I'd call it a book review, but a discussion of a book that I just finished reading, a very fascinating book, and it's called Red Star Rogue, The Untold Story of a Soviet Submarine's Nuclear Strike Attempt on the U.S., and this was authored by Kenneth Sewell with Clint Richmond, and it looks like Mr. Sewell was a nuclear engineer and a U.S. Navy veteran who has a lot of experience with the submarine fleet. And it's a fascinating book. I guess it was a New York Times bestseller. It came out some years ago. Let me look inside here and see when it actually came out. I think it came out first published in 2005. So it's been around for a while, almost 20 years. But this is one of the more interesting Cold War books that I've read, and I thought it would be, I don't know, worth it or interesting to put it out there and summarize it for listeners who may be interested in taking up the book themselves and reading it and making their own decisions on whether they think the author has proven his thesis or not. But anyway, let me just explain to you a little bit about the premise of the book, what it's all about, what it refers to, because I had never heard of this. The book refers to an incident that took place in March, the first week of March in 1968. And before we go into the details, let me first just lay the groundwork. Around the middle of March or so, towards the middle or later part of March, the United States became aware that the Soviet Union had lost one of its ballistic missile submarines. This was a diesel-electric Soviet submarine called K-129. It was launched out of Kamchatka Peninsula in the Soviet Far East Fleet. And then, as now, the U.S. monitored and tracked all Soviet submarines, or at least tried to anyway, that were at sea in the different oceans of the world, and they monitored ours as well. Everybody monitored everybody else, then as now. So it soon became aware, the United States soon became aware that the Soviets had lost one of their submarines, just with signals, intelligence, and various things like that. And the Soviets mounted a search attempt some weeks after the submarine, the K-129, had been declared lost, and they searched in the vicinity of Hawaii, hundreds of miles from Hawaii, and they found nothing, and eventually they gave up the search. The United States then, on its own and in great secrecy, undertook its own search of the missing submarine, and they found it sunk around 350 to 400 miles, I think, northwest of Honolulu. So very, very close to Hawaii. And of course, this was kept secret at the time. And the United States sent down submersible vehicles to take tens of thousands of pictures of the wreck. And they learned a great deal. Apparently, they took out artifacts and examined the wreckage and analyzed it, and it became very clear that there were some very disturbing and unusual things in this wreckage. From studying the remains, and they have ways of doing all this, I'm not going to bore you with all the reasons, and the authors explain how they're able to figure this out, but you can determine a great deal from a wreck, and from photographic evidence, and from physical evidence. They recovered, I guess, a journal, you know, all sorts of things. And the conning towers had been exploded, and it looked like, what was also interesting, it looked like the majority of the crew members of the submarine, there were 93 crew members in total. The crew members had been herded into specific compartments and kept there. So it came to be clear that the only way this could have happened was if the submarine had been taken over by some sort of rogue element, if the submarine had actually been commandeered by someone or party or parties aboard. And from studying the wreckage, it soon became clear, and it was pretty much irrefutable evidence, that the submarine's ballistic missiles had exploded while they were attempting to be launched. Now, how could this have happened? Well, in those days, the procedures for this changed, I think, in 1969 or 1970, but local submarine commanders had launch codes. Now, they still had to get verification from headquarters or from Moscow or from their superiors, but they had more leeway than they had subsequently. So, you know, it was theoretically possible that if a commander was in possession of the codes, he could launch his nuclear missiles. But what they were not aware of was that there were fail-safe mechanisms built into these missiles to prevent unintended or unauthorized launches. There are some fail-safe mechanisms that allow the missiles to explode once they are trying to be launched. So this submarine was commanded by a very, very capable and very highly respected officer. His name is Kobzar, K-O-B-Z-A-R. Career Navy man, very respected captain, and who was slated for big things in the Soviet Navy. So it's hard to believe, or actually impossible to believe. And these guys were the elite of the Soviet Navy. So it's impossible to believe that this guy would have just done this on his own. He would not have tried to launch his missiles at Honolulu, specifically Pearl Harbor, on his own. He was not crazy. He was not a maniac. But anyway, upon further sleuthing and analysis and corroboration of all sorts of different intelligence, a different, very, very disturbing picture began to emerge. And what became clear was that before the K-129 sailed out of its port in Kamchatka, there was a last-minute addition to the manifest to the crew members. Moscow had inserted an additional 11 people who have never been entirely identified or identified at all. And they just added 11 people to a submarine that already was crowded. So that's one piece of evidence that's concerning. Other pieces of evidence also painted a very, very startling picture. And in 1968, listeners may be aware that the Soviet Union and China were nearly at war with each other. They were engaged in a vicious power struggle. Mao Zedong was trying to take over leadership of the communist world, and he opposed Moscow. And there were skirmishes all along the Soviet-Chinese border. And the Soviet Union was deeply aware of this, and aware of the fact that they were vulnerable to the Chinese as well as to the Americans. And also against this backdrop is there were power struggles going on in the Kremlin. At that time, Leonid Brezhnev was the Soviet premier, but he was opposed by a very shadowy group of hardline faction of former KGB and Stalinist era apparatchiks. And remember, in 1968, the Stalinist era was only, you know, had only been over, you know, for, you know, 15 years. I mean, Stalin died in 1953. So a lot of this apparatus was still in place. Khrushchev and Brezhnev had not been able to really get rid of it entirely. And the KGB had a lot of power. So that's one backdrop. Another piece of the puzzle is the Soviet Union was very much assisted in its intelligence collection against the United States by the spying efforts of John Walker. You may have heard of John Walker. He's, by many authorities, consider him the most destructive and dangerous spy because he gave, for you know, decades, he gave the Soviet Union codes and cryptographic information that allowed them to read our signals intelligence. And the Soviet Union was aware that the U.S. Navy was deeply concerned that China might, and China in those days also had, they also had some submarines, and they had possibly the ability to launch nuclear missiles from submarines. It's not clear exactly how much capability they had, but we were worried that a Chinese rogue submarine might attack the United States as well. So there's all this stuff going on behind the scenes, but and readers can, and you can decide, you know, your own version of events, but the author of this book makes a very, very convincing case, in my view, that what actually happened was this. A hardline faction in the Kremlin, or a hardline faction in Moscow, a hardline, old-school Soviet Stalinist faction, headed by a shadowy figure, actually headed by two shadowy figures. One, the name, and this is a name that I had never heard of, and maybe you've never heard of either, but I have since looked into it, seems to be a pretty heavy hitter under the old regime, the name of Mikhail Suslov, S-U-S-L-O-V, was a hardline Stalinist kind of a Soviet ideologue. And he was assisted by KGB head Yuri Andropov, who later in the early 80s became for a little over a year the Soviet premier. And these two were deeply conservative, old school, hardline Stalinist Soviet types. And they saw, apparently, a way to solve all their problems in one stroke by, and this is where it gets horrifying, apparently there was a plan or a plot to launch a nuclear attack, commandeer a sub and launch a nuclear missile against a U.S. city, in this case Honolulu or Pearl Harbor. And since in those days it was apparently difficult to tell where a missile might have come from, the intention was to have it to blame it on China. The intention was to blame the launch on China, and the United States, according to this scheme, would then retaliate against Red China with a nuclear strike, and the Soviet Union would have its two enemies fight each other to exhaustion and to destruction, and they would be able to survive. And this allegedly was the plan, okay? And if it sounds insane, and if it sounds harebrained, and if it sounds completely lunacy, then all I can say is that, you know, you have to use the old principle of Sherlock Holmes. I think Arthur Conan Doyle had his super sleuth enunciate the principle correctly when he said, once you've eliminated all other possibilities for an occurrence, the one that remains, however unlikely, must be the truth. And this hypothesis does seem to fit the evidence pretty well, as I see it. Because in those days, the Soviet Union was deeply aware that it was losing the technological race with the West, and it was also deeply aware that it would not be able to compete with the communist Chinese in the long term, with their population and their willingness to, you know, do everything to better themselves and the nation, their nation. So this seemed, all they could really do was resort to guile and this sort of subterfuge. And it has all the hallmarks of a KGB plot, you know, this attempt to incite an event and then profit from it. But what seems completely insane about it was how this actually transpired. So what the authors have speculated of this book have speculated is that this 11 man team that was added to the crew of the K-129 before it set sail was probably either a Spetsnaz or a Osnaz. These are like Soviet special forces teams in civilian disguise. So this addition to the crew might have been a special forces unit who would have been fanatically loyal and would have followed orders unquestionably. And what this group tried to do was, at some point during the submarine's patrol, they took possession of the ship by force. They could have smuggled weapons aboard or used the weapons that were already aboard and isolated the crew, maybe even killed the captain or some of the officers, and attempted to pilot this diesel-electric submarine to within striking distance of Honolulu and launch their nuclear missiles, their warheads. And such a strike obviously would have killed hundreds of thousands of people, and it would have triggered eventually a nuclear response, almost certainly, presumably against China. And this is apparently what happened. This is what happened. Now, what we don't know is how did the ship come to be destroyed? Well, it's clear that the missiles exploded during a launch attempt. That much is clear from the evidence. Now, a lot of this stuff has not been declassified. So the author is basically trying to draw inferences from what's available in the public domain or what has been released so far. But it seems entirely plausible. And, either the captain, Kobzar, we don't know, maybe he deliberately blew up the missiles somehow. In this case, he would have been a hero. And he saved the world from a nuclear Armageddon. Or it's not clear that maybe he was killed or maybe he was imprisoned and maybe the missiles blew up automatically upon the launch attempt because the special forces team that had taken control of the sub did not know the launch codes or did not know how to disable the failsafe mechanism. That's another possibility. But what's clear is that something very, very out of the ordinary happened aboard this submarine, and it has something directly to do with an attempted launch of those missiles. And all of the evidence points to the fact that this was, in fact, a strike attempt. And for obvious reasons, this was kept secret at the time by both sides, because both sides had an interest in keeping it secret. Obviously, the Soviet Union did not want it to come out that they had a rogue submarine and they couldn't even keep track of their submarines, or there was a secret cabal in Moscow that was attempting to subvert the state and trying to remove Brezhnev from power, because Brezhnev was an accommodationist. I mean, he was basically sort of a guy who was just wanted to kind of ride out his time. He wasn't a super aggressive, fanatical nut job like a Stalin or anything. He was basically just someone who wanted to just coast along and ride it out. And some of the hardliners didn't like that. So they had an interest in keeping the incident secret. And obviously the United States also had an interest in keeping the incident secret, because if it had come out that we were seconds away from a nuclear strike on Hawaii, literally seconds away, and the only thing that stopped it was pure luck, or not luck, but, one rickety failsafe stood between us and nuclear Armageddon, then the public would have panicked. And this was already at a time when the Vietnam War was at its height in 1968, and the public was already deeply jittery, and the consequences of that information becoming generally known would have been catastrophic as well. So both sides had an interest in keeping this secret. So what happened later is even more fascinating. In the early 70s, the CIA made a semi-successful effort to raise this sub from the depths. And to do this, the story of, and it was called Project Azorian or Project Jennifer. It's two names it goes by. You can find it under either one of those names, Project Jennifer or Project Azorian. And to do this, obviously a submarine is an extremely heavy and massive piece of machinery. So to do this, to actually try to raise this, they had to construct a special ship. And they turned to none other than the billionaire Howard Hughes, who had the money and the desire to do. He you know, as we know, he was an aficionado of all these sort of eccentric engineering projects. So I guess he assisted them in doing this, and they did in fact raise the submarine a little bit, and I guess it broke apart when they tried to raise it. It's not clear exactly how much they were able to get out of the raising, but it was basically semi-successful. A lot of the information has still been classified. Nixon did not obviously want that to get out. That was a very, very important state secret, because there were, you know, there would have been code books among the wreckage, and you know, submarines are very, very valuable pieces of technological gear that someone can learn a great deal about if they study them scrupulously. So we kept that secret. My understanding is that in the 1990s, during a visit to Russian President Boris Yeltsin, an American official, I guess, gave Boris Yeltsin a videotape of the wreckage of K-129, or I guess we also buried some of we buried at sea some of the sailors that were aboard the vessel, I think, but we only buried some of them. I think it was only like six or seven. So that's the story. That's the information. I encourage you to read the book for yourself and decide whether you think that Mr. Sewell has proven his case. I think he has, in my view. I think the book is very well written, very cogently argued. Yeah, it's got some photographs in it. This is not the work of a conspiracy theorist nut job. This is the work of someone who's a very, very shrewd and competent technical expert, a nuclear officer aboard the U.S. Navy, someone who has many years of experience. I think the book is in many ways very, very disturbing, very terrifying, because I think the takeaway lesson from this is that if this happened then, you wonder how many other close calls have we had since then, or are we still having? I mean, who knows how many horrific plots have been averted, maybe terrorist plots or terrorist bombs or mass casualty events, things like that. And it reminds us that we have to be vigilant. We have to be vigilant because there are evil people out there that are willing to do insane things. I mean, the other thing that's shocking about this is the fact that if this plot is true, if this the Mikhail Suslov, Yuri Andropov plot is true, how could these guys ever think that they could get away with this? How could they ever think that we would not eventually find out what happened, and that eventually they would have to be called to account for what they did, or that the Soviet Union would be immune from the blowback of such a catastrophic triggering of a nuclear war? I mean, how could they have ever thought this? But who knows? Maybe they really were that crazy. Maybe they thought, hey, we can trigger this event. We can ride out the blast. We may lose a few 10 million people, but in the long run, we'll be able to survive. And we will somehow keep on trudging forward. And this type of sick mentality really is out there. I mean, there are people that really think this way. There are people that really are that dark and are that fanatical that they would do something like this. And we have only to look at current events around the world, in Europe, in the Middle East, in other places, to see that there are bad apples out there, and a lot of them are in positions of power. They're in positions of power. So that's my summary of Red Star Rogue, or my summary of the argument of Red Star Rogue. And I encourage you to check this book out. Let me know what you think. And until then, keep on rolling and keep on crunching.